the water buffalo meat did have a set price. It was, at that time, it was 250 kip per kilogram. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter if you were getting a chunk of bone or fat or meat, it all went for the same price. Mm-hmm. And so you could, if you got there early in the day, you could point out which, they would bring in one carcass in an open trailer mm-hmm. behind a Jeep, and the flies were around and everything, they'd hang that thing up and start whacking away, and when that one was sold, that was the end of the meat market mm-hmm. for the day. And so if you got there early enough, you could pick out the part that you wanted, and they would cut that off and weigh it up and do it. Everything else was bartered for. You had to pick your own price. And your melon lady, you would squat down in front of her and pass a few pleasantries first, and what a nice day it was, and then asked her why she brought those ugly-looking watermelons to the market. Mm-hmm. She says those were the best watermelons and you know, available. Mm-hmm. And you said, well, they aren't even ripe yet. And she would say, they're the sweetest ones I've ever tasted. And you would go back and forth, and, well, are you giving them away? And she says, no, you probably don't have enough money to even buy one. And you would just dicker back and forth and finally decide on a price, and then you'd do your deal. Or you would stand up and walk away, and then she'd call you back and try to barter a little bit more. But one day I went to, I decided I was going to buy a papaya. I'd mm-hmm. never bought one of those. But they were in size about the same size as papaya, or pineapples. Mm-hmm. And pineapples, I had determined, were going for about 250 kip. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, I don't know what the price, going price is on this. We'll just see. And if I can get it for like 250, that sounds like a fair price to me. And so we started to barter, and I asked her how much she wanted for those, and she said 20 kip. And I just about dropped my teeth in my drawers at the same time and paid her 20 kip and didn't barter anymore. But the papayas were imported, mm-hmm. and the cassava, or the pineapples were imported, mm-hmm. and the papayas were local, mm-hmm. and so that made the difference. And so, but it just, I couldn't even do it. Mm-hmm. Couldn't even barter for that. But it got to the point where we could almost pay the same price as the wild person going mm-hmm. to the market. Our skill was, bartering was a lot of fun, I thought. And it's a very pleasant way to do things, and there was a lot of cultural stuff in there. At one point, we went across the Mekong to the town across there, and there was an air base 20 kilometers from there that the U.S. Airmen came into all the time. So they were used to seeing some Americans, but all the prices were set in the shops and all, as far as price tags. And we went over there, and for some reason we were going to buy Linda a scarf. So we wandered into the shop, and they had a price on it in baht. Instead of asking in English how much the scarf was, mm-hmm. we asked in Lao, and Thai and Lao, just across the border from each other, mm-hmm. are very similar. Mm-hmm. Everybody, immediately, the price was half of what was marked on there, just because we asked in Lao. Mm-hmm. The price was not what you should be paying. Mm-hmm. You know, the servicemen coming in, mm-hmm. seeing whatever it was and paying it. But Thai women asking her what American men liked, as far as girlfriends, mm-hmm. because they were anxious to get out.
Is there a kind of person who was interested in doing that? And a kind of local person? Or was it just...
It was the young, pretty girls.
Young, pretty girls.
Yeah. Yeah. It was their ticket out of that area, I guess. And a number of the Americans would take a lot of wives while they were there. Mm-hmm. But then when they...
And, when you were in Vientiane, did you ever go to any IVS meetings with other rural development people to kind of share what you were doing?
I think they had an annual meeting when we were there, and we went to that. Vientiane stuff were, I don't know, the bureaucrat type people, mm-hmm. and we were not that. We were more human, mm-hmm. and everybody else had.
Well, you came back to the States.
Yep.
And this was 1968, rather. So it was, but it was before. Let's see. I didn't write that down. August. You went to Clark Air Force Base and had the surgery
in, yeah,
I
was 67, yeah.
And then...
No, 68.
You got there in July of 67.
Yeah, July of 68,
July of 68. And then you... What did you do after that?
I came home and I couldn't work. I just had a back operation.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved on some land that Linda's folks had here in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
They lived in a duplex and we bought a trailer and moved it onto their land.
Mm-hmm.
To work in an egg, chicken didn't work at all until just about Thanksgiving time, I guess. I got a job planting trees on a wino crew, actually. The guy would go to Portland and bring a busload of guys down from the Bowery there.
Mm-hmm.
And he had two crews. At the end of every day, he would pay off the guys. He would furnish them a motel,
mm-hmm,
and food, and he would pay them off in booze, and the next day they were so hung over they couldn't work, so he had the second crew to work that day. But then after they had sobered up for 6 or 8 hours, they knew if they didn't work again they wouldn't be getting any more booze.
Mm-hmm.
So they would work the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It was an every other day thing for most of them. And I got a job on with them. I think I only worked for them for 3 or 4 weeks, and then I got a job with a state planting trees.
I almost said planting Christmas trees.
Yeah.
Planting trees. And what happened after that?
Then, let's see. That was the winter time.
Mm-hmm.
Linda had a few more credits to finish up so that she could get her degree,
mm-hmm,
and we found that Pullman, Washington, Washington State University had courses that would fulfill it. So we went to Pullman, and she finished up her credits. She actually got her degree from the University of Illinois,
mm-hmm,
but she had credits from there. I got a job working as a carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
We applied the jobs, and we decided whoever got the job first, that's where we'd go.
Mm-hmm.
And I got an offer here in Salem, working for the Bureau of Land Management.
How long did you work for the Bureau of Land Management?
About 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I quit and been doing employed since then.
Mm-hmm. And Carol?
Home repairs,
mm-hmm,
and all.
Mm-hmm. And Carol? I mean, I'm sorry, Carol. Linda.
She, let's see. I've probably done more of the farm work than I have.
Mm-hmm. On the answer machine, it mentioned something about a press.
Oh, she's also a writer.
Uh-huh.
She freelance writes.
Mm-hmm.
And actually see how long she's been doing. She's got a weekly humor column in the local paper,
mm-hmm,
and there's a monthly goat newspaper that,
mm-hmm,
comes out of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a new book called Life in the Goat Lane,
mm-hmm,
and she's got another one that's at the printers right now,
mm-hmm,
on raising teenagers.
How many children did you have eventually?
Two boys.
Two boys.
They're both computer people.
Mm-hmm. Where?
The oldest one is working in Seattle for a company that is an internet provider that has a filtered internet field. You,
mm-hmm,
you don't get pornography.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he wrote the program that filters this.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger one is at Berkeley getting a PhD in computer science.
Computer science. Well, that's wonderful.
Don't take much.
No. No, it doesn't. You seem to have simply, but rather beautifully.
Yeah.
And the one consistency of virtually all the volunteers is they all have, it doesn't matter whether they were English teachers, run through all these experiences. Well, that was very pleasurable. See, nothing bad happened. It worked out pretty nicely. And if I can think of something else, I'll be sure to contact you again, you and Linda Fink, and we'll find,
mm-hmm,
out all the things that you left out and all the secret things and also the deeper understanding that she has. So that'll be fun. Okay, thanks a lot.
I think the one thing that we were most disappointed in, and this we didn't know it at the time, and we didn't know it when we came back, but over the years, realized IBS's role with AIDS,
mm-hmm,
and the military.
Mm-hmm.
We, as a conscientious objector, I wasn't in love with the military or mm-hmm. what they were doing. And we didn't realize we were playing that big a role, that it was what a quasi-military operation that we were involved in.
How did you get that understanding?
Just thinking over it over the years. Mm-hmm. The fact that we had to call in once a day.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that if we didn't call in, it was the CIA that would check up on us. And Mike,
you knew it would be a CIA officer who would come and check to see
it.
It
was he that would plan on the road with mm-hmm. his airplane, yeah, mm-hmm. or his helicopter. Mike was his name, mm-hmm. The name we were given anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't realize it. Villagers would come to us with American change and ask us to change it into Lao money.
Mm-hmm.
We say, where did you get this?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, the soldiers that were two valleys over.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, there's no Americans around here. Well, the Americans were there, and yet everything you read in the newspapers and all, no American military. And when we came back and we would tell people about things that would happen over there, there's a lot of things you just couldn't tell because nobody would believe it. They had heard the
like
military.
What would be an example of that?
Like all these soldiers that were two valleys over.
Mm-hmm.
And here the people, you know, brought all this money to us. But they weren't there. There's one incident, one of the places that we went swimming one time, it was just a few kilometers from our village. And I'd heard that there was a little skirmish over there, and it didn't amount to anything. And 3 weeks later, we were asked to leave our village because we were pulled out of our village because of the security situation. Well, this incident had happened 3 weeks ahead of time, and 3 weeks before, and now they were just hearing about it and worrying about it. And, you know, if they were going to protect us, it was 3 weeks too late. So we, you know, and we realized a lot of things that were done over there were done with the military. It wasn't aid, it wasn't community development. It wasn't for their good.
Well, this is an interesting issue, especially for the Laos folk, because of the lack of infrastructure, the USAID had to supply everything that you, mm-hmm. you needed, and you also you had to fly on their aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed natural.
Some of the stuff we supplied, they didn't need.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that had happened before we got there was that aid had furnished enough concrete to them to improve their airport.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Lao people themselves walked all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even own cars. It was the Chinese and the Vietnamese who owned cars.
Mm-hmm.
So why did they need a new airport? So they took the cement and built a great big structure in downtown Vientiane.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big, fancy, probably 3 or 4 story open-air building with gold leafing in, and it was their temple.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were introduced to that, they said, well, this is the Vientiane Airport. We said, it doesn't look like an airport. Well, that's where the concrete went.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were improving roads there for people that walked all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
They had no need for a lot of the stuff that we were there.
Mm-hmm.
Their national budget when we were there was $69 million. And 55 million of that was supporting things that the Americans needed rather than what the Lao needed. Their budget before we got there was like 14 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we're improving the whole thing, but it wasn't improving the people themselves. Andy and Carol will tell you that a lot of the Lao people that we worked with or were in the government then are still in the government now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, there's no taxation in the villages. Until you owned a motor vehicle or a store,
mm-hmm.
no taxation at all. So it really didn't matter who the king was or who the official was or anything. The pictures of the kings were all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew who it was and they were loyal to him. But it really didn't matter. You know, you didn't have to pay.
What was the war all about then?
As far as the people were concerned, there was no reason for it,
mm-hmm.
as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no reason to die for something that there was no reason for. And that's why they did what they did. And, you know, it's sort of like they're the survivors. You know, if somebody wants to get mad at somebody else, well, that's their problem, but it's not mine. And so it was...
Did you read Roger Warner's book or any other books on the secret war in Laos? Back to the States is when you really realize that there might have been a military strategic purpose for what you were doing. Did you hold IVS accountable for that?
Well, I think I do a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Their a major part of their funding over the years has been through aid.
Mm-hmm.
And military budget or not, I don't know.
Well, how would you answer the position that, you know, Laos is one of the poorest countries in the world. There's a kind of civil war going on. Parts of the country is, of course, actively engaged in the war in Vietnam. But the average person, you know, lived very simple lives,
mm-hmm.
with very few conveniences,
mm-hmm.
or even an atmosphere in which agricultural development, unquote, could take place. And IVS has all these young, enthusiastic kids who want to know, want to
mm-hmm.
engage in another country in a way that has nothing to do with the military. And Laos is a place where those people can go and make those kind of contacts and introduce some of those improvements on a people-to-people basis, that might help generate loyalty for a government which happens to be pro-American.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay.
Yeah, I'm agreed with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the two areas that IVS should have been involved with, or anybody should have been, and we could have helped and really improved the Lao people,
mm-hmm.
was in sanitation
mm-hmm.
and education.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that probably was their major thrust.
That was, seems to be their
yeah.
major thrust, yeah.
The bigger projects, when aid got involved, was irrigation projects. There was one project over there that they built the ditches and put the dams in and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, hired local people to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work. And so they redug the ditches, and it didn't work. And after they redug the ditches three times, one of the Lao people said, the only problem with this project is that you're trying to get water to run uphill, and it probably won't. And that was the thing. They were going to run their ditches uphill, basically. But even to have irrigation here, the Lao traditional lifestyle was to work your head off for 9 months of the year, take advantage of the weather and all, and the other, and they worked hard. They worked from sun up to sundown, and in the hot season they had 3 hours in the middle of the day when you didn't work, but you know, that was their deal.
Yeah.
And the other 3 months of the year was when all of the political and religious holidays fell in.
Mm-hmm.
It was a time for house building. It was a time for doing things that you couldn't do when you were out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And so we come along and we say, if you would irrigate, you could double crop. You can get another whole crop of rice by working your tail off in these 3 months that you're lazing around.
Mm-hmm.
And so they should work twice as hard, three times as hard, to get a little more rice to be able to sell for things they probably didn't need anyway. We would bring radios over there or cigarette lighters. Well, they didn't have batteries. They didn't have lighter fluid, so they'd put gasoline in it when it worked. Motorcycles, if you give them a motorcycle, they had no mechanical skills at all, because they could build a house with a machete, an awl, and a crosscut saw.
Mm-hmm.
The whole house, and that included hinging things and pegging things together. But if the motorcycle ran out of gas or ran out of oil, they just, you know, they didn't have the background and mechanical
mm-hmm.
skills to really take care of it. So I think had we put our efforts into education and sanitation and birth control, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
We would have really made a contribution. But we got into some other areas that our agenda wasn't theirs,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't fit with either their lifestyle or their religious ideal.
You're absolutely right. In of course, a lot of this is what we call self-predictive. It just seems that the people who we've interviewed thus far actually were focused on either education or sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
That is, these water seal toilets, which, whether they worked or not, that's what they were.
Yeah.
USAID was supplying mm-hmm. the money for it. And also the well tiles and digging wells
mm-hmm.
and trying to...
I think both of those were needed projects yeah. and good ones.
And they weren't in the case of telling Lau that, you know, this will make that, you know, that we know better than you how to do this.
Yeah.
But that rice project sounds very typical of USAID policy.
Mm-hmm.
And the road building was all being done by USAID.
Right.
And some, by the way, IBSers were doing that because they said, hey, this country doesn't have any roads.
Mm-hmm.
If it had roads, people could get goods to market better. So
yeah.
they went into this massive road building program. And that may have served a military purpose too, but I think the former IBSers involved in that were probably thinking more in lines of
yeah.
of infrastructure. It would be interesting to look back at the IBS projects in Laos and see just how much of the thing is that you feel like you wish they'd done more in that regard.
Well, I think they did quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like producing new rice varieties. You know, that's a good idea, but if your new rice variety requires commercial fertilization and the people can't afford the fertilization, we were supplying them with insecticides, pesticides, seven. They were mixing that with their hands in open barrels and applying it into the paddy rice and stuff, wading around in it. Never a warning that what it would do to future generations or to them or anything. You know, we did some grave injustices over there as far as I'm concerned. Wanting to convert to a different rice variety that
mm-hmm.
requires commercial fertilization, that isn't fair, I think. You know,
mm-hmm.
that wasn't a step forward. Sure, they could grow more rice, but at what cost?
Mm-hmm.
And doing what Americans thought was best, and that not all the time do I think that was to their, you know.
You've remained on the IVS alumni list? You receive things from IVS?
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever contributed money?
Little bit, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not a whole lot. We live a very low income
mm-hmm.
thing. But a lot of that is due to IVS.
Mm-hmm.
We found out you don't need 16 cars and a boat and don't have the money for something, we don't buy it,
mm-hmm.
you know. We've bought land on time. That's the only thing we've ever bought on time. Most of our own food.
And you raised, apparently two exceptional children.
Yeah, they've done pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them have got some stuff. Each of them, after 4 years of college, Kevin's college would have cost like $80,000. Steve's probably $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they both came out of loans. They had to pay back $6,500. About.
But Laos experience for you was one of learning to live a simple life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And being happy with a simple life.
Mm-hmm.
The people there were happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could go swimming in the middle of the day and laugh and party and everything. They worked really hard, but they knew how to live life.
Were these mostly lowland Lao that you were?
They were when we were there,
mm-hmm.
but they were villages that had been forced to leave the highlands
mm-hmm.
Along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They would go up there and the Americans would go in and say, there are communist sympathizers in your midst, you have 24 hours because we're going to bomb you.
Mm-hmm.
And they would.
Mm-hmm.
Anything they could carry out on their backs down a mountain trail in 24 hours, they were allowed to take away. And we'd tell them, if you can get down to the valley, get down to the Mekong Valley, we'll help you resettle.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would come down, these Highland people would come down, not the mountain yards, we really didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
That. And we,
well, and these were not Hmong.
Not really, they're, yeah. But, you know, they would get down there and we would give them tin sheets for roofs.
Mm-hmm.
And American shovels and hoes and rakes, which were too big for them and didn't...
Village, those villages along the highway,
mm-hmm.
were most of those resettlement villages?
All of them were.
Yeah, I had a feeling that's... I saved this to the end because I had a feeling that this was...
Yeah, there was some... Yeah. Some of the original villages interspersed mm-hmm. along there that the road happened to go by, mm-hmm. but no, the resettlement was all along the road because that's where the Americans could get to mm-hmm. in their vehicles. Mm-hmm. They weren't going to resettle somebody.
Well, the ones that you in your village, what kind of agriculture, did they try to continue to practice the agriculture they'd been practicing before, or did they have to become reconciled to?
Right where we were, they had grown Highland rice, mm-hmm. Slash and burn method.
Right.
And they still did that where we were, actually.
So there was enough land resource in that area to do...
The land was owned by nobody.
Uh-huh.
The land, anybody could claim the land if he wanted to clear it and plant his rice and use it for 3 years until it was exhausted, and then you would move on and clear some more.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no ownership. Laos was the second most undeveloped nation in the world, we were told.
Yes, everyone always is the second most,
yeah.
by the way. there's a whole scholarship on that, how do you describe. No one ever says, this is the poorest country in the world,
well, they
because
told
there
it,
are too many people who
they
can...
They told us Yemen was the worst.
I don't think so. Mozambique after a civil war. Tanzania, when I was there, was always called the second most poorest because mm-hmm. of Mozambique. That is the same economy, but they had a civil war, and Tanzania did not, so that mm-hmm. made it number two. I've been to Yemen, and it's hard to believe in a material sense, but
mm-hmm.
with food and, I don't know. I just look at the question of a stable personal environment. That is, do you have the things that you would expect to have and consider yourself a success here?
Mm-hmm.
And if you have all those things, you know, minimum, your dietary needs are met, you're not hungry,
mm-hmm.
your kids have a chance at a better education than you, you have a roof over your head that's the kind of roof that you expected to have,
mm-hmm.
and it functions. And, you know, to me, that's development. All the other things may be artificial. Like, you don't have potato chips, so that's,
mm-hmm.
you're not developed. And then you have, you know, kids see television, and now they want the potato chips. Well, to be developed, you'd have to have that, too.
Yeah.
Because your perspective has changed of what you need to be successful. A thing called praxis, a lovely sociologist, but I'll talk to Carol Ierson about all these things to see if it makes any sense. But I'm glad we got to that. You notice this is all after we had stopped. no, it's still going.
Oh,
no, I meant after. I said, well, thank you very much for talking. Is there anything else, kind of thing?
Yeah.
And then we went on and then got into the things that really did matter, which
that,
is very
that
lucky.
That really has been,
uh-huh.
you know, my disappointment mm-hmm. over the years. And frustrated at the time,
mm-hmm.
at times. But we sure liked it, and as CEO, you know, you think a lot of things. I think there should be a universal draft
mm-hmm.
for people in the United States. Everybody should be drafted, boys and girls, immediately upon high school graduation, or if you drop out of high school, immediately.
Mm-hmm.
2 years, and pick whatever you want to do. Certainly the military can't absorb all these people.
Mm-hmm.
If you would like to join the Peace Corps, that would be an acceptable 2-year project. If you want to work in a mental hospital, if you would like to work in the forest, overseas, if you can't pick something, we'll pick something for you, and it might be the military or what all. But everybody put 2 years in, married or not, kids or not, you know, just know right off the bat, you're going to have to put 2 years in somewhere. Disabled or not, there's typing jobs, there's, you know, pick up litter. If you can't find something else, we'll let you pick up litter for 2 years. And I think there would be a lot more national pride. It would give people, kids, a chance to say, I've been thinking about forestry, why don't I work in it for 2 years? And they'll find out, boy, this is what I want to do, or this is what I don't want to do. And both of those things would be a valuable thing to know. Babysit, you know, conscription at that time.
So it's a good idea with currently almost full employment. I don't think anyone in Congress is going to say, let's take this low-wage workforce and get it, sock it away somewhere else. But, I mean, I would agree with you.
Yeah.
I would just call it national service.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever.
And you could have it, and I think it would be,
mm-hmm.
it would
develops all those kind of what self-reliance and responsibility issues that everyone talks about. And the question is, an overseas service, you know, what good can one do? And maybe from this study, people will realize that they need anything.
Yeah.
Some volunteers feel frustrated because they didn't do anything.
Yeah.
That they learned, they got more out of their experience than the people got out of them. Well, it was a valuable experience, and one said, yeah, but they paid us for it. Well, you know, then I said, well, $80 a month. Yeah. You know, how much is that when you think of how many billions were funneled into Southeast Asia by just USAID alone?
Right.
And how it did not result in what they had hoped in it politically or even economically. It's such a bad idea to have, there's a thing called the Defense Education Act, where people learn foreign languages as a security issue. It's important to have Americans study foreign languages. Well, it's probably also to have Americans who speak Vietnamese and Lao and who know that area. John Summer, for example, Ted Kennedy, on hearings about Vietnam. You can see he'd been there.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have those people in society to have a function. Of course, now we have a Southeast Asian population that's burgeoning. I think the Philippine population, just Filipinos alone, are probably the largest immigrant community in the United States, and are getting to be. And Southeast Asians are taking their place in that melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
And IBSers are kind of a bridge. A lot of IBSers served as liaison. And when, you know, these, I know one teacher who simply said, my gosh, we've got 60,000 Hmong. You know, now, I was in Vietnam, but at least I know. So that's Catherine Walker in near Fresno, and so I think in that sense there's an investment return. I think what you're talking about, that national service would have that for all those different areas. But, no point telling students that they need to get out and do something responsible, but not require everyone to do something that's responsible.
Yeah.
Because then it just becomes too random.
Yeah.
But we'll see, won't we? The future has yet to be written. Man is not perfect, but man is perfecting him. Who knows? We'll see. Well, again, thanks a lot. And if you think of something, one more thing that you'd like to add, you can always call me.
Yeah.
And I'll set the tape running, you know, just like that. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.